Well, I'm going to do, this is Dina Balon, the VP of Sustainable Hospitality for NEWH, and I'm going to do a quick introduction and then hand it over to Mike. First of all, I want to thank everybody for joining us today and let you know that if you are attending and would like to get CEU credits for this webinar, you will get information on the very last slide at the end of the presentation. As well, if you would like to ask any questions, please type them into the chat area on your screen, and I will ask them at the end of the session as well. I also wanted to thank our sponsors, and we have two wonderful Green Voice sponsors, Global Lighting and JLF Lone Meadow. Without them, these wonderful events would not happen, so thank them very much. And our NEWH Sustainable Hospitality Committee puts a lot of time and effort into these, so I wanted to do a little shout-out to them as well. I'm going to introduce Mike really quickly and then let him introduce the panel that he has. Mike is the Principal Director and Director of Design at Stonehill Taylor. He has an extensive background in developing unique and complex high-profile projects for both well-known and boutique properties. Mike has done the project that they're going to talk about today, an American-made hotel, which just is so interesting to me, and I am very excited to hear about it. So, Mike, with that, I will hand it over to you.
Thank you very much. Today, our panel, we have with us Margie Waldman, who is the president of the Stroud Group. They are the handled the purchasing, sourcing and purchasing of all of the FF&E for the entire project, which was broken down into two phases, which I'll go over. And also joining us is Tracy Chevalier, who is the Senior Vice President of Soho Myriad. She was one of our suppliers. Her company oversaw the sourcing and procurement and creation of all the custom art that was installed in the project that we're going to review today. And both of them will be speaking a little bit later about their roles and what made this project unique. So in terms of what the project is, we all worked on a project that was the renovation of the Hyatt Regency that is located in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's an existing hotel that is in downtown Minneapolis. When we began working on it, it had been around for about 25 years and was 650 guest rooms and 60,000 square feet of event space. And the scope of work, there is the location, which came into play much later in the project. We got started on it in May of 2011, and we were brought on board by a developer who was working with the ownership group. The ownership group consisted of three different parties: the Hyatt Hotels Corporation, who had owned the property for quite some time, owned 100% of the property for quite some time. A new partner that had purchased 50% of the property several years ago, Starwood Capital, Barry Sternlicht's organization. And the third ownership group is Haberhill LLC. They're out of Delaware. And they were brought on board as not only a owner, but also as the developer to oversee the renovation of the hotel and to act as the executor of the capital that was being put towards the renovation, and I'm going to oversee the property from a operations standpoint. The property is operated by Hyatt Hotels Corporation, and the ownership breaks down roughly 50-50 between Starwood Capital. They're each equal owners. Haverhill is a minority owner. We were brought on board by Haverhill. A fellow named Doug Green reached out to us at recommendation by Hyatt Hotels Corporation, who we had worked with extensively on five or six other Hyatt Regency properties that had similar scopes of renovation. The objectives of the project that we were asked to proceed with was an extensive renovation of most of the existing areas and an addition of new spaces. This was overall objectives. The project itself was broken down into two phases, which I think we have broken down a little bit later on. But overall, over the course of the entire length of the project, which, again, was in two different parts, that extended over the course of about 2 years, a little bit more than 2 years, we ended up renovating most of the existing areas in the hotel. And we also took an adjacent building, which I'll show you some images of, that was formerly a retail building that had been essentially mothballed, and we converted parts of that building to new hotel spaces. This is what the reception lobby looked like when we first arrived at the property. It was sunken. There was a fountain. Let me bring up a little arrow. And I'm giving you this just as a little bit of context. I'm going to get into some more before and after pictures at the very end of this presentation. But when you first walked in, you were in a two-story space that was lit with daylight from skylights. You arrived on grade with the porte-cochere with the driveway, and there were steps down into a lower area, a large pool, trees that were growing in the middle. Reception desk was down here underneath this sort of control tower looking set of windows that poked out into this atrium space. People dragged their bags down these stairs all day long. There's stairs on the other side of the pool as well. There's no apparent way to get down to where the reception desk was without going down the stairs. And then this was open to areas over here, and on this side, this side was essentially a large sort of dining hall, and on the other side was a sea of lounge seating that didn't really have use. It was very underutilized. One of the initial things we did was we converted that main entry space into a dramatic entrance feature. From this, we felt we had to hide this. We couldn't actually change the room that was behind this window up here, so we ended up covering it with a two-story fireplace and an art piece that resembles logs and a large sunken living room, and then we put in a series of ramps so that access was clear. We relocated the front desk so that it was very obvious where the front desk was. So to go back to what I was talking about in terms of the scope of the project, we were initially hired to do a project that was to renovate the existing 532 existing guest rooms. They were about 12 years old and were in need of, the FF&E was about 12 years old, and it was in need of a complete replacement. The bathrooms had not been significantly renovated since the building was, property was opened, and the bathrooms needed to be gutted. We were also asked to rework the lobby reception lobby, which you just saw the before and after pictures of, as well as the existing F&B areas, which consisted of the dining hall and a sports bar called Spikes. They had two F&B areas. We were also asked to create a new marketplace. The initial budget was $26 million, and the initial schedule was told to us to be 13 months. The budget and the schedule were material to our contract for signing up as the interior designer and the architect for this project, and we had to agree to stick to both the amount of time and the amount of money that they had set. Haberhill was a stickler for both of those, which is not unusual. But what was unusual is that they had presented to us a scope of work which, in our experience, would normally take anywhere from 15, 16 to about 18 months, depending on the kind of process that we went through and how they handled bidding and procurement, as well as buying out the general contractor's work. There was a follow-up project to this, which we've called Phase 2. The initial project wasn't really presented to us as Phase 1. It was just presented to us as the renovation of the hotel. With the success of the first phase, they quickly announced that they were going to have us do an addition to the hotel. We worked out a way to add 112 new guest rooms in this old retail building that had previously been used as a showroom building, kind of like the Merchandise Mart or the D&D building, but had been empty for approximately 10 years. And we also were asked to find a way to add approximately 30,000 square feet of new event space. I apologize for the dollar sign on this slide. It was 30,000 square feet of event space, not $30,000 worth of event space. The Phase 2 budget for this work, the 112 new guest rooms and the 30,000 square feet of new event space, was $25 million, and we were given a much shorter schedule once we began working on it full speed ahead. So in total, the work that was done was about, I can't do the math, I guess $51 million. So the shortened schedule was of particular concern to us when we began the project in May of 2011. We were told that they wanted to try and capture summer occupancy in 2012. The initial goal was to try and have it open by May of 2012, and we discussed right off the bat how we felt that was going to be something difficult to achieve. We had told Haberhill, who was controlling the project, that in our experience, and given some prior Hyatt work, that we should expect this kind of work to be done on the outside 18 months, and that 13 months to us seemed extremely aggressive, and it was unclear to us how we were going to achieve that at the beginning of the project. So we began by working on a set of ideas with Haberhill, with Doug Green. Doug also had presented to us, in addition to the budget and the schedule, Doug Green from Haberhill had also said to us that from the ownership groups, he didn't quite make this clear exactly who he was talking about, but from the ownership groups, for political reasons, because we were running up into a primary election year for the President of the United States, that for political reasons from amongst the ownership groups, there was a desire to try and spend money within the United States so that they could use that however they wanted to from a political standpoint. They were part of a certain party and wanted to show that they were supporting American jobs. So that was put out in front of us as a desire that wasn't really spelled out. And as we began working through how do we achieve a shortened schedule like this with a large scope project, a complete renovation of the guest rooms, a gut renovation of the bathrooms, tear out all the fixtures, all new finishes in the bathrooms, new plumbing fixtures, and then a major renovation of all the public areas. We came up with the concept of Proudly Made in America as a not only a design concept that was going to affect how we thought about the project, how we designed the project, but also how the project would be sourced, and procured, and delivered. That would potentially allow us to get the project done in a shortened schedule. We also felt it was particularly timely given the political atmosphere at that time in the spring and early summer of 2011. The U.S. Major newspapers and television news pundits were all discussing the Republican and Democratic Party's platform for president of bring jobs back to America from overseas. How do we create more jobs? And both parties were waving that flag. So we thought this was a great idea. Is this the only way I can go forward?
I just double click.
Okay. So given that as our starting point, Haverhill loved this idea. And we, before we could present it to Hyatt or to Starwood Capital, we had to define what local meant. If we're going to buy American or buy local or buy regionally, we had to take it upon ourselves at the very beginning of the project to determine what that meant for this project. I want to go back to one of the earlier slides. I don't know if there's an easy way to do this. I want to go back to the slide of the map of the United States. So the Minneapolis is located in Minnesota. Yeah. It's it's north, the northern sort of central part of the United States, right near the northern border, not far from Lake Superior. And Minneapolis is located right on the Mississippi River, which kind of runs down here between the states. And it's very close to Canada. So early on, we also when we began, I think Margie, your company, was already brought on board by Haverhill, even probably even before we were. Is that correct?
That is.
Yeah. So we had discussions with Doug Green and with Margie and her partner Michael. And I think, Margie, it was you guys who said we need to look at not just the United States. You want to talk a little bit about that?
We were fairly limited in the manufacturing capabilities at that time of what was available in the United States. And we have other vendors both in Mexico and Canada for seating in Mexico and case goods, as well as seating in Canada, that we wanted to be able to consider because their lead times were so much better. And their capabilities were greater, and it was the type of quality that you were looking for.
So we decided, based on those early conversations, we, as a team, us and Margie's company, Stroud, as well as Haverhill representing ownership, we all decided that our concept of Proudly Made in America, which we all loved, was really going to be Proudly Made in North America. And our goal was to maximize the dollars that we spent within North America and minimize the dollars that we spent outside of North America. The goal was, at the earliest stages of this project, the goal was really this concept of proceeding with this idea of regional sourcing was really driven by the fact that we're going to be held to a 13-month overall schedule. and the amount of time it takes to procure a model room. I think in the case of this first part of the project, we did two model rooms, and we also had several other pieces made in addition to the two model rooms from other vendors. The amount of time that takes to go through that process with three owners and settle on final vendors, on final designs, then go through the process of shop drawings and procuring product for the rollout renovation was going to be exceed 13 months if we had to ship things from overseas, both for model room and for production. And we began proceeding this way right off the bat with the concept. As we developed the design of the model room, we were given about 2 weeks to develop the model room design and then another 3 weeks to produce the documents so that Margie could go out and start shopping it. This idea of proudly made in America or proudly made in North America, we, from a concept standpoint, from a design standpoint, we focused on what does that mean from a standpoint of having this hotel in Minneapolis. And we wanted to focus that idea of proudly made on Minneapolis itself and then the greater state of Minnesota and what that means from a cultural standpoint. Historically, what the industries of the state were, and I'll get into that a little bit further on. So, once we had made that decision, it fell on Margie's shoulders, Margie and her partner Michael's shoulders, to work to identify local vendors and suppliers. My firm, we've done a lot of hotels, we've done a lot of work with Hyatt and a lot of other hotel ownership groups and brands, and we've worked with a wide range of suppliers in all categories of FF&E that you'd find in a guest room. But for the most part, in the last 10 years, many of those suppliers are located in Asia. They may have offices here in the States, but the actual manufacturing or assembly is done in Asia, and the stuff has to get containerized, put on a ship, and brought across the Pacific Ocean. And we just didn't have time for that. And while we knew that there were certain vendors in the U.S. that we had worked with previously, we certainly didn't have the range of relationships or prior experience to find multiple vendors in each category that met this criteria of Made in America. So it was really Margie who spearheaded that. And Margie, do you want to talk a little bit about how you guys found potential suppliers and vendors?
Sure. We have a really large database that we're always updating. So one of our categories actually is country of origin. So we started there and had to expand it because at the time that was still new and things that were made in America weren't always made in America. We just went through I think we bid out every category. There were at least six vendors, and we looked at also importing options just to check pricing and make sure that it wasn't that far off. And there might have been someone that could have done both. The biggest problems we had were in some of the categories. There is nothing in those categories that is made here anymore. You can't find.
You know what? I'm going to jump to that slide, Margie.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. You can keep talking about this. And this slide represents some of those things that we had trouble obtaining in North America. You want to talk about each one of these?
Yeah, these are the biggest challenges. The carpet industry in America has done a great job of mimicking Axminster, but they don't make Axminster. And that definitely was a requirement. So we started with that in the public spaces very early on, and that was just something that we all had to agree was going to come from overseas. But any of the vinyls, the sheer materials, They're made offshore. Recently, there have been some upholstery vinyls that are being made here, and lighting is a huge issue. Historically, most of the lighting manufacturers would import parts anyway and assemble here. There would be some things that they would manufacture, but when the recession hit and before that, they were all importing finished products to the United States. There are a couple of more retail-oriented manufacturers that will still make some things here. There's a ceramic-based manufacturer that's here. So we ended up with a manufacturer who does import but assembles here so that the quality control is here. It's in their factory. We don't have to wait 5-6 weeks or longer to get new pieces in, which is a huge consideration because the design was very, very fresh and very new, and it was not the type of product that anyone had at that point. So it really was going to take some time to get this all figured out.
So, Margie, you're bringing up a good point that the benefits, which I'm going to get into a little bit later on, this first part is about process, but the benefits, we found that we were able to cut time out of a variety of different areas of the traditional process, including samples, shop drawings, final control samples, and in addition to the amount of time it would normally take to ship from overseas. We put together a slide which is based on Margie's data from Stroud for both phases. I think, oh, no, this might be phase one. I think this is phase, oh, no, this is a combined total of both phase one and phase two. So this, we spent a combined total of 82% of all the FF&E dollars from both phase one and phase two of this project. I think phase one was higher. It was like 86%. Phase two was in the high 70s. Because phase two ended up being a lot more Axminster carpeting because of the 30,000 square feet of event space and a lot fewer guest rooms than phase one. But this map represents the total dollars spent in the U.S. and how much we spent in various locations represented by the size of those blue circles. Margie, do you want to talk about a couple of these locations and what may have been made?
Sure.
In different places?
Up in Washington State is Electric Mirror, so the lighted mirrors for the bathrooms were all made from them domestically. They also import, but for this project it was done domestically. Down in California and Mexico is where the upholstery was manufactured. Over in New York,
Who were those manufacturers?
NLP, which unfortunately they're not. They're now American Contract Seating took over their facility, and they did phase two as well. NLP did the first phase, and American Contract Seating did the second. They had all of the same plans and whatever. We have in Georgia is where Soho Marriott is. They did all of the custom artwork for the rooms as well as for the public areas. The guest room carpet was made in Georgia. There's a couple things that went on in New York. We had all of the drapery and the bedding that came from New York, as well as there was a fabric manufacturer in there that made fabrics for some of the seating and for the headboard.
I think that's where do we get wall covering from?
We have wall covering from several different companies, so they're really all over. We have it in Icon is in Tennessee, North Carolina is Wolf Gordon, and they all manufacture in those facilities.
Tracy, you guys handled with Soho Marriott, you handled a majority of the artwork, which was all custom made for the property and the project. Do you talk a little bit about what you guys do at your facility in Atlanta?
Well, I think the benefit of having your team or working with your team is that you gave us some really clear objectives about the art. And so we started off looking for local artists, specifically in Minneapolis, and kind of spread it out a little bit. And then we kind of go towards from the city to the whole state. And then depending on what we found, then we sort of also started looking at more of artists that had that kind of tipped their hats to the local industry. And that's how we found the artists that did the art in the guest rooms, which was basically 3M packing tape on light boxes.
We have this piece here.
Yeah, it's Mark Keisman. So this artist actually takes 3M packing tape and makes these images by doubling up the tape and making it darker in certain areas. Usually he doesn't let us reproduce or make prints for guest rooms, but in this case he did. So that was really that was a great find for us.
I think we have also a couple of other images of custom pieces that were made by your company.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's so our team starts off and they kind of engross themselves into the arts community in a certain place, and then they talk to artists, and then artists tell other artists that we're looking for people, and that's typically how we operate. In this case, the corridors came from Rosemary Dunbar. She's the one that did the series in the court. Yes, they're down. Yeah, there you go.
These are made out of, she uses maps of the area,
right? And then combines them. And then there's also Matt Olig, who's, there you go.
Oh, yeah, Matt is from Minneapolis, I think, right?
Yes, he is, right.
And this is actually a quite large piece, and he did some monumental pieces. I don't know if he works in acrylic or oil, but he was actually painting one of the pieces at the grand opening on an easel so that all of the people coming to the grand opening could see him working.
And then the cool thing about also finding these regional artists is that, you know, we're working with you on another project, and we get to use that same sort of group and go back to them and hopefully be able to use them in a different way with a different piece and you know, stimulate the arts community in Minneapolis.
Yeah. So I wanted to revisit this. One of our goals, just like with all the other FF&E for regional or local sourcing, some of the art pieces like the paintings by Matt Olig, and I think is the person who did the corridor art out of the maps, was that a local person as well?
Yes, she was too, yes.
So one of our criteria was we wanted to find local artists, meaning people from Minnesota. Another criteria was we also wanted artists who were inspired by and would utilize materials that represented the state of Minnesota. So 3M, the 3M company, which I think most people are familiar with, 3M stands for Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing. And while they don't do any mining, or they don't anymore, they have built their company over the last 100 years by inventing products like Post-it notes, masking tape, scotch tape, whiteout. And so you had found this artist who uses 3M, I think, I don't know if it was masking tape or packing tape.
It's packing tape. It's clear, yeah. It's like that clear brown tape. And then he layers it to get the darker colors.
And we had that artist created this image of Ingrid Bergman, who is America's most famous Swedish-American, Scandinavian-American actress. And we wanted that. We wanted her as an icon for this property because Minnesota was really populated by Scandinavians, by people coming over from predominantly Sweden and Norway. So as we progressed with the project, and Margie and her team at Stroud were identifying more and more North American vendors, I think I'm going to skip through this because Margie, you already spoke about what we couldn't make, but we found out through our research that we couldn't make from a standpoint of either quality, like lighting, or cost, like vinyl, or the fact that the equipment doesn't even exist in North America anymore, like Axminster carpeting. We found that there were things we unfortunately couldn't make anymore. We progressed and found a group of vendors that we felt represented a range of products and multiple vendors in each category. And Margie, you had to go through an aggressive bidding process because for Hyatt and for Starwood Capital and Doug Green, the bottom line was that they were not going to spend one penny more than what their budget had originally been set at. And so while they thought this was a wonderful approach to getting a project done in a shorter amount of time and focusing their dollars on our country or on North America, you still had to prove that we weren't spending more on local sources than if they were buying the stuff from overseas. And do you want to talk a little bit about the bidding process you went through?
The bidding process had to be obviously very quick, and we made sure that we were also accounting for the spend for the transportation, which had become a lot more expensive in recent years because of fuel costs. And Doug Green is very familiar with air freight costs and didn't want to repeat that either. So that was very important when we were comparing product and vendors so that they would know. And we did have, a Chinese company also pricing it, so we would have that baseline. And it was just a matter of going through it because not only was it price and it was quality, but it was that time that really made it very difficult. And on some of the products that we did have to source outside of the United States and North America, it was a little bit nail-biting at times because we didn't have that much time to get this product in there.
I recall, Margie, that from your spreadsheets that sometimes you were bidding a single product category against two or three North American manufacturers as well as two or three Asian manufacturers. So sometimes it was up to six different companies that were bidding on a single item.
And those were just the ones you saw. There were others who were discounted because they couldn't meet the criteria.
Timing?
Yeah, it was whether timing or their pricing was ridiculous. They didn't have the capacity. There are still some smaller manufacturers in the United States for case goods, but they wouldn't be able to meet the aggressive schedule we had.
Did you, can you talk a little bit about whether there were any North American manufacturers? What was their response to this idea of us trying to focus our manufacturing on North American companies? Did you get any positive feedback from any companies?
A lot of them, they were all very excited. Unfortunately, some of them were saddened by the fact that they didn't have facilities here anymore, and they couldn't maintain the schedule because they weren't manufacturing here. But I have seen a huge shift in that since this, and a lot of these companies now have or are starting or getting back their facilities in the United States.
Did you, since we had the benefit of doing two phases that were about a little bit more than a year apart, and from a standpoint of the bidding process, did you notice a shift from phase one to phase two in resources within North America?
Since we went with the same product, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel and have anything look different, so we really... it was a scaled-down version of the bidding when we did that.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, not really. No, not at that point.
But overall, you feel that there's been a shift in our industry and more traditional manufacturers are looking at manufacturing their products within the U.S. or North America?
Huge shift. There's been a huge shift. I can tell you several manufacturers who typically in the past 10 years have been manufacturing offshore and are now getting facilities back. They're not 100% back, but, some of them will just do their model rooms here, which they used to do anyway and then stopped, but now they're doing model rooms here. Some of them are having smaller manufacturing facilities for public space, things. Some of the lighting people are starting to do more assembly here, which is wonderful. But it has a way to go, but it's definitely increasing.
So the second part of our presentation, which is a bit shorter, is the benefits. And this has been actually since we completed phase one, and then again since we've completed phase two, we started to realize what the benefits were of this process that we went through. When we were going through it, we thought it was a good idea. We were hoping to end up with a product that everyone was happy with, but more so, I think all of us were focused on the fact that we had such a short schedule and we had a very hard budget and we had to get things done with those constraints. But afterwards, you know, you can reflect on what has been accomplished. I have done some research on social sustainability. I had done this a while ago for another client pre-recession, and we were doing a project which was primarily focused on environmental and social sustainability with the goal of having, in a similar way, the art produced locally, but it was going to be produced by school kids. And at that point in time, I read a book called The Triple Bottom Line, which approach to running a business. And one of the three parts of the triple bottom line is profit, which was a primary driving factor for our clients. Another part is the planet, which we all have come to know as green design or environmentally sustainable design. And the third part of this triple bottom line approach or this tripod are the people. The people in the community, the stakeholders that go beyond the ownership group and operators of the hotel and guests, but also the people who live around the hotel, the people in the city or the town or the village where the hotel is or the state or the region or the province, are the people who are in the country where that property is. And this approach is taken by businesses as varied as like Walmart, or as large as Walmart or Amazon, where they look at not only where is the product coming from, how it's made, but also what are the conditions for the people who are actually making the product? What are the benefits to the people in the community where that product is made? So social sustainability, one of the definitions is that it's social sustainability occurs when the formal and informal processes, systems, structures, and relationships actively support the capacity of current and future generations to create healthy and livable communities. Socially sustainable communities are equitable, diverse, connected, and democratic, and provide a good quality of life. What this boils down to is that a socially sustainable community is a community in which everyone thrives, and they're producing things, they're making things and consuming things that come from within their own community. The dollars that they spend are being spent, or the yen or the pounds that they spend are being spent within their own town or within their own state, and they've got a cycle so that they're not supporting some people on the other side of the planet. They're actually supporting the area that they live in, and that they're providing not only economic stability for those people, but they're providing environmental sustainability for those people, and that's about the people itself. That three-part approach to creating a well-rounded business or a solution for a project has that social sustainability as a key component. And oftentimes in our business of hospitality, social sustainability is not something that's typically discussed. It's not necessarily focused on. United States Green Building Council focuses on the environmental impact of what we do, how the environment is affected by the fact that we build buildings and operate buildings, and where do those products all come from. But the social component is something that very few organizations focus their efforts on. There are a handful. I was just introduced to one recently that really tries to police the business of making handmade rugs over in India and Pakistan, with a goal of trying to eliminate child bonded labor or child slave labor. That's an organization that called Goodweave that is really only is primarily focused on the social impacts. But there aren't a lot of organizations like that. That the this part this image I put up because the in a nutshell that approach of social sustainability is to nurture communities that nurture your business. And the that benefit, nurturing a community and in turn that community nurtures your business, is has ended up being one of the biggest benefits for this hotel in particular and the owners of this hotel. And I don't think it was a goal that they had initially set. And they were taken a little bit by surprise. They found out, and we found out as we progressed through this project and it was completed, shortly after May of 2012, there was a grand opening party. It was about 13 months after we all began on the project. We had completed the first $26 million worth of renovation, completely renovated all the guest rooms, and redid all of the main public areas. The owners were very happy. The operator was thrilled. They had a brand new hotel. The staff was very excited and energized by it. The manufacturers who worked on this project benefited. And they benefited in a way that, Margie, you just spoke about. And we didn't really think about this while we were going through phase one, but right after this project was finished, we began working on another part of this hotel that wasn't really on the table when we began working on it. And the manufacturers who had helped us achieve our successes in the first part, you just went back to for the second part, it sounded like, for the most part. I'm sure that you checked their prices, but you made the shortcut of not aggressively bidding like we did phase one. And those manufacturers, including Tracy, I guess you, were given phase two without having to reprove yourselves. The local contractors and consultants, of course, benefited, and this is typical for most jobs. We had a local contractor, Mike Johnson, and MPJ Construction. He acted as a general contractor, and the consultants were our MEP, structural. They were all local. Even though my firm is located in New York City, we agreed that we were going to use local consultants for that project. We felt it was the right thing to do. And then the local community and the guests started to benefit. And the way that happened was the guests, of course, are benefiting because it's a brand new property. But the local community heard about what we had done. And also some of the people who work, all the people who work in the hotel work in that community. And some of the staff started telling me that they were bringing their parents in to show them the hotel. And not long after phase one opened, we found out that both the person managing the marketplace and the head chef had gone out and started to source a lot of their product that they were using in the kitchen locally from local farmers, and that the stuff that was being sold in the marketplace was being made locally and represented the local community. And there was a synergy that started, which has carried through today. From a standpoint of the brand, Hyatt, this is a Hyatt Regency, and at the end of the day, this remains a Hyatt Regency. How did that brand benefit? And they've actually looked at this project in depth because of the positive feedback that came out of phase one and the amount of press that we received from it. It was an enormous amount of press, both national press as well as local press. And we also got trade press, but we also, surprisingly for us, we got press in USA Today, and we got press in a lot of other newsstand publications that we didn't expect to get press in. And the press wasn't really focused on the design. It was focused on the fact that we made this proudly made in America project. So the brand stood up and took notice. And Hyatt had some discussions with us. And we went through what those benefits were. Obviously, as we've been discussing since the beginning, one of the biggest benefits was schedule compression. We cut 5 or 6 months out of the overall initial project schedule, and we did the same for the second phase. We did that, as I had said earlier, by shortening the model room process itself, and we greatly shortened the production procurement of the FF&E for the rollout. We also compressed the schedule by abbreviating the shop drawings and the submittal process by having manufacturers who are located in North America and within one or two time zones of us. It was much easier to get feedback same day from them, and we could get overnight shipments from them for submittals and send things to them overnight instead of waiting a couple of days. And then, Margie, as you had said, the local shipping versus overseas shipping, I think, was dramatic. Can you, Margie, what's the difference between sending something by truck or rail across the U.S. versus overseas on a container ship?
When you really strip it down, there's about a 30% differential in some cases for when you add in the overseas freight. When you talk about, you know, you still have the freight from the port to the facility or from the manufacturer if it's stateside to the facility, but it's that overseas freight and the number of containers that and the insurance and the drayage and the everything that goes along with it. And in some cases, it's about a 30% add-on. It balanced out that between the cost of the goods versus all in with the freight, there really wasn't a huge difference at the end of the day.
Dollar and cent standpoint, but in terms of the amount of time.
Well, we saved months.
Yeah.
We saved months. There was no way that it could have occurred the way it did. Shipping it from locally, it gave us the ability to ship it by floor instead of just containers full, which have to be packed in a specific way to eliminate as much damage as possible. And but when you're shipping from Canada or somewhere in America, you can ship it, pretty package it how you want it. So that helped a lot, too. We didn't have as much warehousing. It's saved in many more ways that aren't really visible.
Yeah. We also shortened our lead time for construction materials. Our general contractor did his best to source everything, actually, from within North America, and he focused primarily on getting as much stuff built, pre-built, in Minnesota as possible. We also, early in the process, identified local products. Minnesota stone, we found one quarry that still took stone out of the ground for use commercially called Cold Spring Granite. We pulled all of the stone for the bathrooms out of that northern Minnesota quarry. We found a local pottery company. We used their Red Wing pottery. We used little crocks. We built them into the desks as pencil cups. And now their products are one of the primary products sold in the marketplace. I'm kind of running out of time, so I'm going to go quickly through this. There was a bit of investigation done by Hyatt on the social benefits, and they had gathered and collated some data about the benefits that had occurred within the immediate neighborhood around the hotel as well as Minneapolis itself, and they found that their impact was quite large, that a lot of the local business owners had heard about what we had done. They were supportive of it. They had formed relationships with some of the staff at the hotel. And the marketplace in particular now sells locally made products. The market that's in the hotel sells some locally made products. The last time I was there, they were even considering selling locally made shoes in that hotel market. The brand benefits for Hyatt itself, the benefits from phase one, the successes that we had from phase one allowed us to do phase two, which wasn't even a thought that it existed with this ownership group. But the success was so great, and they saw that success really quickly after we opened phase one, that they launched phase two in 6 months. And they phase one was $26 million, phase two was $25 million. This is an image of that merchandise smart-like building that's attached to the hotel. We ended up cutting a massive hole that's about the size of a football field through the floors of that building to create a large multi-story space in the middle of it, which we turned into a very large ballroom and then built new event spaces around that. And then on the outer walls of that huge building, we put new guest rooms, 112 new guest rooms. So this was such a successful project that we all got to work on another project of equal size right afterwards. And then Hyatt, I wanted to put this up. Hyatt has their own program called Hyatt Thrive. This is a program that is focused on primarily on environmental sustainability. However, there are new initiatives within the Hyatt corporate organization that's beginning to focus on the social sustainable opportunities that they now see as being very viable from the Hyatt Regency Minneapolis project that we did. And so that's made me very proud that we've had that kind of impact. I'm going to quickly go through some of the results. These are the before and after pictures. You've already seen the reception area. Oh, that was the old front desk. It was dark, low ceilings. It was very hard to find. That's the new front desk, which is right when you walk in. Again, that's the image you already saw. That was that looking down on that pond that was in the middle of the old lobby with the ficus trees around it. And that's what it looks like now. It's become kind of a social center as opposed to, I think probably which was a good idea, a water feature and trees, but now it's actually where people gather. That was the dining area. It was kind of like a large food hall. It was a two-story space, even though you couldn't really tell from when you first walked in. That's part of the lobby as well. That's that food area. There was a long buffet counter kind of front and center. We broke that up and created some divisions using a central bar as well as large curtains so that we could break the space down and make it a bit more human scale. This is the old marketplace, the new marketplace. That was actually the old sports bar, which was, we combined the bar with the restaurant, and they used to have a separate bar, and we've turned that into new event space. We increased the event space by 50% over what they used to have. They went from 60,000 to 90, a little bit more than 90,000. This is what the guest rooms used to look like. Very early 80s or late 80s looking. The new guest rooms, which you guys already saw a picture of. The old bathrooms, which were split, they were kind of motel style with a vanity outside the bathroom. And we made the bathrooms much larger and relocated the vanities. This is that stone from Cold Spring Granite that we found in northern Minnesota. Oops, and I've gotten to the end of our show.
Thank you so much, Michael. I really appreciate it, and the presentation was wonderful and very thorough. We do have, you can see up here on the screen that if you are looking for CEUs for this session, they are available, and this is the information that you need. That information also will be emailed out, and you can do a survey for us as well. That would be great. I want to thank our panel very much. This was a great presentation, and I learned a ton. As we are out of time, I'm not going to list any of the questions. However, I wanted to let everybody know that this presentation will also be on newh.org, on our website soon. Look for it in about a week or so, and you can go back and see everything again. All right?
Great, thanks very much.
Thank you.